Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 707, Update on Eurofascism. This program is being recorded on March 28th of the year 2010. Before we launch into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you of the website spitfirelist.com. It is by far and away the best individual source for information of this kind, and please utilize it. I've now got my entire life's work up there for download for free, and I'm in my fourth decade of broadcasting. And there's a new feature, Food for Thought and News and Supplemental. Those of you who only check the website for programs should get in the habit of checking it more often, because I update it several times a week. I add an individual article of interest and significance in the Food for Thought section in the upper right-hand corner of the website, again, spitfirelist.com. As I replace those, they begin feeding down the left side of the front page, and then when they go off that, they go into the News and Supplemental section. So when it says select a category, you select News and Supplemental, and away we go. So please, spitfirelist.com, a mini library of old anti-fascist books. Everything I've done for 30 years plus at this point, long written descriptions of the programs, and now updated several times a week in the Food for Thought section. Now, this broadcast is, again, update on Eurofascism, and that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to bring ourselves, the audience, up to date with developments on the European fascist scene. In For the Record 702, I talked about the imbroglio surrounding Tiger Woods' extramarital affairs, and I wondered to what extent this may have been something of a political operation. Certainly, the Tiger Woods' inclinations to stray, so to speak, are, I guess one could say a natural human inclination, if not an actual human manifestation in many cases. But what I find interesting is not so much the fact that Tiger Woods had extramarital affairs, but the huge media flaps surrounding this. Now, certainly, Tiger Woods had a very squeaky clean public image, but one of the things that I noted was not only the obsession that the National Enquirer has with the Tiger Woods case, and the National Enquirer was founded by Generoso Pope, a former CIA psychological warfare officer, but also the media handling of the case. I was particularly struck by a cover story in Vanity Fair magazine in which Tiger Woods is seen bare-chested pumping iron with a watch cap on, very much like a con. And I speculated about the Tiger Woods case as in some ways OJ2. The Vanity Fair cover photo had been darkened, rather like photos of OJ Simpson both after his arrest and after his conviction, or after the civil case was founded. And I've noted in that context that not only was golf a white bastion of sorts, but also the fact that Tiger Woods had considerable acceptance among white people. He had an image and a persona that was very acceptable to white folks, and he was at the same time breaking a very significant color barrier. When you're knocking them down at the Augusta Country Club, at the Masters down in Georgia, you're crossing a very serious bastion, a very serious color line indeed. And I also speculated about the possibility of a psychological principle being employed in this case as psychological warfare called stimulus generalization. In addition to the fact that Tiger Woods was an African-American penetrating a previous primarily all-white bastion, or damn near all-white, so too Barack Obama, another African-American who had a generally large acceptance by white folks, and who also had crossed a color line and penetrated a previous all-white bastion. Obviously, he became the first African-American president. I noted in one of the Food for Thought articles that Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, considered by many a Republican frontrunner for 2012, referenced Ellen Woods in his address to the Conservative Political Action Committee, saying that we should take a page from her book and smash out the windshield of the, and then he basically was using a metaphor, the Democrats' car, using a nine iron. One of the things that I noted in connection with the Tiger Woods case, and again, this is speculative, but wondering whether perhaps underground Reich elements may have helped to set this up and exploit it, I noted that his mother-in-law, Ellen's mother, Barbro Holmberg, was the former Swedish Minister of Immigration. And in that regard, I noted a couple of things. Sweden has turned into something of a haven for war criminals of various stripes, including Baltic SS unit veterans who had committed war crimes and were basically given shelter in Sweden. What we're going to look at during the first part of this broadcast is the history of Swedish fascism, not only its history in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, but its manifestations up through today. Sweden, as I noted in For the Record 702 in connection with discussion of the Tiger Woods case, Sweden, although neutral in World War II, was a country that obviously was Nordic and therefore filled with, quote, Aryan, unquote, racial types, viewed with favor by the Nazis and other eugenicists. Sweden also, although neutral, had very strong links to the Nazi power elite. In particular, many of Sweden's top industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-Nazi, and many of them had professional connections to the industrial and financial elites of other countries, including Nazi Germany. Hermann Göring, Reichsmarshal and chief of the Luftwaffe in particular, had formed very strong links with elements of the Swedish aristocracy and power elite. And by way of fleshing out that speculative discussion of Tiger Woods, we're going to take a look at some of the history of Swedish fascism, which is not as insignificant as some might imagine, but also has very strong implications for today. We're going to begin by taking a look at a short excerpt from a website called, it actually appears to be an online book, Archives, Institute for the Study of Academic Racism. The full URL will be available in the description for the Record 707. We're going to take a look at a fellow named Per Engdahl, who was not only arguably the most important historical fascist in Sweden, but also an individual who, as we looked at in For the Record, in Miscellaneous Archive Show 61, his Malmo International Conference, about which we're going to hear more in a second, was a key element in helping to perpetuate above ground, note my phrasing, above ground neo-fascism in Europe. It really should not be called neo because it isn't neo. It's simply the same old fascism perpetuated down through the decades. And one of the top journals of European fascism, some would call it neo-fascism, is Nacion Europa. And Per Engdahl had a lot to do with helping to coalesce the forces that created and are perpetuating Nacion Europa. Skipping down in archives, two Italian journalists, Del Boca and Giovanna, surveying fascism throughout the world, wrote in their book Fascism Today, quote, Nacion Europa has for many years been considered to be the most authoritative organ of European neo-fascism, unquote. Nacion Europa was established shortly after the Second World War by a former Waffen-SS officer, Arthur Erhard. Associated with Nacion Europa were many old Nazis attempting to reorganize Nazi activities throughout Europe. In 1951, a fascist international conference was held in Malmo, Sweden, attended by more than 30 fascist leaders. The purpose of the conference was to lay the basis for future fascist activities. The conference was organized by the Swedish fascist Per Engdahl, last name E-N-G-D-A-H-L, first name P-E-R. Continuing, an observer of the fascist scene wrote at the time, quote, Dr. Engdahl, the organizer of the movement, is conspicuously associated with a German journal which may be described as the brains trust of the fascist international. Nacion Europa, a well-produced monthly published at Coburg, claims to be laboring in the service of European nationalism. Early contributors included many of the remains of the old Nazi elite, i.e. Hans Grimm, Karlheinz Priester, Oswald Mosley, Julius Avila, the Italian racist whose works are highly recommended in Nouvelle École, see page 76, and Maurice Bardèche, the French fascist who started a book with the statement, Je suis un écrivain fasciste, I am a fascist writer. Adolf von Todden, the ex-leader of the NPD, is a regular contributor, and Richard Verall of the National Front's directorate and editor of the National Front's paper Spearhead is also a contributor. And an obituary of Per Engdahl, again, whose sponsorship and convening of the Malmö Conference of the Fascist International in 1951 was a key element in helping to perpetuate above-ground European fascism, now referred to incorrectly, in my opinion, as neo-fascism. Per Engdahl's obituary was carried in the British Independent newspaper of May 24th of 1994. Excerpting that obituary, when, as often happened, speaking of Engdahl and skipping down, when, as often happened, he was labeled an old Nazi, Per Engdahl, leader from the early 30s of the New Swedish Movement, unquote, angrily used to protest that the label was incorrect. No Nazi he, but he certainly was a fascist, a believer in corporatism, and a longtime admirer of Il Duce, Benito Mussolini, whose posthumous triumph in the latest Italian elections Engdahl must have savored before he died on May 4th. His death was only made public in Sweden 2 weeks later, after the funeral. By the way, the election referred to here is the coalition in which Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia party, along with the Alleanza Nazionale, was elected in 1994. They have since come to power, and as we've looked at, they come to power again, I should say, and as we've looked at, there are strong links between Berlusconi himself, a member of the P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli, and also elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. And there are also links between the Alleanza Nazionale and the fascist Muslim Brotherhood as well. Skipping down in the Independence obituary of Per Engdahl, again, the prominent Swedish fascist who convened the Malmö International and whose sponsorship helped to create, to perpetuate Nazione Europa. Skipping down, we read, the Allied victory in 1945 left Engdahl and his minuscule fascist movement high and dry in a country where there had been a considerable number of Nazi and fascist sympathizers until the turning point of the war with El Alamein and Stalingrad. He went on publishing the movement's magazine, Wagen Framat, The Road Ahead, and often managed to make friendly contact with younger politicians who initially did not know who he was or what he represented. He liked to point out what he saw as corporativist traits in the prevalent social democratic ideology and tried with limited success in his autobiography translated Freebooter in the People's Home, i.e. the Swedish welfare state, to portray himself as a nice elderly statesman with ideas that might be somewhat off base, but not necessarily out of date. In later years, Engdahl became a passionate pro-European in contrast to younger extreme right-wingers in Sweden who tend to oppose Sweden's entry into the European Union. Almost totally blind, Engdahl nevertheless participated insofar as he was given space in the newspapers, more often on the radio, in Swedish political debates. His new Swedish movement was like himself, reaching a ripe old age, but possibly getting some new recruits among clean-shaven youths with boots, who usually expressed their political leanings through immigrant bashing and denying the fact of the Holocaust, an issue on which Engdahl wavered. So that, again, is Per Engdahl, arguably the patron of Swedish fascism. Now, again, as I noted in some of the supplemental discussion to For the Record 702, many of Sweden's most prominent industrialists and financiers were very sympathetic to fascism, if not doctrinaire fascists. One of the most prominent of those was Axel Wenner-Gren, whose brand name Electrolux has become something of a household appliance word in the post-World War II era. Axel Wenner-Gren was an ardent supporter of Hitler. The very prominent Wallenberg family of Sweden also had not only very strong fascist connections, but you talk about nice work if you can get it. The Wallenbergs basically had a worldwide monopoly on the production of ball bearings and were financed by their own commercial bank, the Unskilde Bank. Indeed, as we looked at in connection with the U.S. industrial connections to fascism, the American subsidiary of the Wallenberg's worldwide ball bearing monopoly appears to have been implicated in betraying plans to bomb the Schweinfurt ball bearing raids in Germany. The Schweinfurt raids aimed at the very prominent ball bearing factory in Germany appear to have been deliberately betrayed to the Luftwaffe in advance, And the head of the subsidiary, the American subsidiary of the Wallenberg ball bearing monopoly, has been implicated in that. That by Charles Higham, author of, among other titles, Trading with the Enemy. Perhaps the best-known member of the Wallenberg family was Raoul Wallenberg, who disappeared in the Soviet Union while on a mission supposedly to save Jews. In fact, what he was doing was engaging in one of the last-ditch attempts on the part of some leading Nazis, including Heinrich Himmler, to barter the freedom of some of the remaining Jews in Europe in exchange for, basically, freedom from prosecution. What we're going to look at now is an article, one of the first of two stories, dealing with a prominent Swedish writer, a late prominent Swedish writer named Stieg Larsson, last name L-A-R-S-S-O-N, a prominent writer of crime fiction in Sweden. Larsson's books are now being turned into movies and are seen as probably having a considerable impact on the American cinematic environment. Stieg Larsson's books, essentially novels, at least ostensibly novels, in fact, were of the genre that represented real events as fictional events, simply because the real events were too controversial. And indeed, as one police official, whom we're going to see quoted in a subsequent article, maintained, all of the events that were in Stieg Larsson's very successful novels were real. Now, one of the things to consider as we examine not only this story, but a subsequent Vanity Fair article by Christopher Hitchens about Stieg Larsson's death, is that one of the things that figures prominently in the fascist landscape that Stieg Larsson wrote about, and that is not only slave prostitution, but some really horrible aspects of the underground sexual scene involving the making of snuff flicks, and again, slave prostitution and some extremely sadistic sexual practices. One of the things that Stieg Larsson had been writing about and investigating, and he also was an active anti-fascist, and that was the illicit sex trade in Sweden, and not only the use of slave prostitutes, but also some truly barbaric practices involving very sadistic and in some cases lethal practices towards women. Apparently, one of the problems that Sweden has been dealing with is an uptick in very extreme violence against women, and this appears to be connected to this fascist underground, which is run by some of the most prominent figures in the Swedish overground, or their Swedish overworld. And again, one of the things that looms in this, that concerns the trafficking in young women into Sweden, in particular from the Baltic states and from other areas of the former Soviet sphere of influence, I guess one could say. And in that context, of course, it's possible that Barbro Holmberg, Tiger Woods' mother-in-law and the former Swedish immigration minister, may have been compromised at some point, because if she winked at any of this, she would then be owned from that point forward. And bear in mind that, as we looked at in For the Record 702, Sweden has become something of a haven for war criminals of various types, including Baltic SS war criminals. The following is an article called The Dark Side of Swedish Society. It's by Stephen Armstrong. The full URL will be available for this in the written description for the program. And this deals with Stieg Larsson and the movies that are being made from his novels. Skipping down, this week sees the film adaptation of the first book in Larsson's trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, released in Britain. So far, more than 2.5 million Europeans have seen the movie, and No Country for Old Men producer Scott Rudin has just inked a deal to make the Hollywood version. By the time Rudin is finished, many millions more will have followed the story of investigative journalist Michael Blomqvist and a chaotic, freewheeling computer hacker Lisbeth Salander. What they find at the end of that story, however, may shock them. Tattoo begins as a slow-moving, gently unfolding detective story, but ends with scenes of horror beyond anything Hannibal Lecter could imagine. Throughout the book version, Larsson keeps dropping genuine figures relating to violent crimes against women in Sweden. The Swedish title for the book is Men Who Hate Women, and footnotes, quote, real-life incidents to explain how the fictional Salander, whose civil rights are removed at the whim of a judge, is based on real incidents. Larson, as with Bettner and Moncal, spends much of the time pulling apart the stereotype of happy ever after, perfectly educated, socially democratic, and joyfully tolerant Swedes enjoying wild sex lives and perfectly cooked meatballs. The Millennium Trilogy tracks Blomqvist and Salander's attempts to uncover mysterious murders in neo-fascist billionaire families, as well as state-sanctioned violent sexual abuse, pedophilia, and rape. Larson himself was a campaigning anti-Nazi journalist who set up his own version of the British anti-fascist magazine Searchlight, so you can see why he'd take this path with his fiction. Moncal, however, was a well-established mainstream author before he created Wallander. He did so in order to investigate pedophile rings at the heart of Sweden's security services and expose public and institutionalized racism. Wallander was born in May of 1989 out of a need to talk about xenophobia, so the story came first, and then him, says Moncal, another of the Swedish authors of crime fiction, a genre that's become very popular in Europe. Continuing with the author's statements, I was writing the first novel out of anger at what was happening in Sweden at the time, the rise of xenophobia. That was my ambition, and since acts of xenophobia are a crime, I needed a police officer. Even after the second and third books, I really wasn't thinking of a series. Then, I realized I was creating a tool that could be used to tell stories about the situation in Sweden in the 90s, unquote. Wallander and Blomqvist also wade through some of the extremely unpleasant undercurrents beneath Sweden's tranquil social order. In Larson and Mankell's stories, both men encounter neo-Nazis who collude with SAPO, the Swedish version of MI5 and MI6 combined. In their version of Sweden, racism is rife, violence against women is commonplace, while the trafficking of children for sex is facilitated by highly placed lawyers and doctors. So a number of things to note here. Note that the links that are talked about here, note the links that are talked about here between, quote, neo-unquote Nazis and the Swedish intelligence service, SAPO. Also note that many of these unsavory activities are countenanced and, in fact, facilitated by very powerful figures in Swedish life. And again, bearing in mind Barbara Holmberg's background there. But note the links between the Nazi elements that Stieg Larsson and others have investigated and the Swedish intelligence service, and in turn, the connections between Swedish power structure and these, quote, neo-unquote Nazis. Skipping down in the story, little of this would come as talking about the findings of an uptick in sexual violence in Sweden, and also some very unsavory disclosures concerning organized sex trafficking. Little of this would come as a surprise to Larson, Blomqvist, or Salander, who encounter all of this and more while investigating the brutal murder of a child, apparently at the hands of her rich, Nazi-sympathizing family. Quote, Sweden has yet to come to terms with its Nazi past, says Anna Blondell, who runs a Swedish restaurant in London. Again, quoting, we were neutral during the war and our Nazi party still lives on. In fact, I think it will do well at the next election under a different name. Many people in the older generation were very sympathetic to Nazi ideas like eugenics, but unlike Germany, we have not been so open about this, unquote. Certainly, the country practiced forced sterilization of women deemed unfit to be mothers as recently as 1975. Branded low class or mentally slow, they were kept in institutes for misled and morally neglected children where they were eventually treated, unquote. In 1997, the government admitted that 60,000 women had been sterilized. Meanwhile, IKEA founder and Sweden's richest man, Ingvar Kamprad, revealed his youthful Nazi sympathies in 1994, confessing to a 9-year friendship with Per Engdahl, the openly pro-Nazi leader of the neo-Swedish movement. Kamprad claimed he couldn't remember if he joined the Nordic Youth, Sweden's equivalent of the Hitler Youth. I would take that disclaimer as I would not only take it with a grain of salt, I would take that as sort of I can't recall, meaning, yeah, I did, but I don't want to admit it. And that, again, from Sweden's current richest man and the founder of nice, fashionable IKEA. What we're going to do now is to launch, and we may not have time to finish it on this side, so we'll just continue with this in side two. There was an article in the December 2009 issue of Vanity Fair magazine by wordsmith par excellence Christopher Hitchens. It was called The Author Who Played With Fire, and it goes into some of the literary aspects of Stieg Larsson's writing and also the fact that Swedish crime novels have become very much the vogue in Europe, and also talks about the forthcoming release of the films and the fact that Stieg Larsson might very well have become a very wealthy man as a result of the publicity that his books were going to get, as well as the movie contracts themselves. He also talks about Stieg Larsson's very real-life activism as a professional anti-fascist and threats and actual plots against his life by some of these, quote, neo-Nazis, unquote. He notes that Stieg Larsson died of an apparent heart attack on November 9th, 2004, which is the anniversary of Die Kristallnacht. However, Christopher Hitchens, who generally will shy away from the word conspiracy when it surfaces, Christopher Hitchens concludes that Stieg Larsson's own lifestyle, and apparently he did not live a particularly healthy life, was responsible for his death. Again, he died on November 9th of 2004. November 9th is a very interesting date in the history of Nazism. It was on November 9th, 1918, that sailors in the Baltic fleet, in the Baltic port of Kiel, in the German high seas fleet, raised the red flag in revolt against the Kaiser's regime. That began an abortive socialist slash Marxist revolt in various parts of Germany. This was basically what brought World War I to an end. It was precisely because November 9th was the beginning date of the abortive German Revolution that Hitler picked November 9th, 1923 to be the date for the beer hall putsch. Later, that same date, November 9th, 1938, was deliberately selected as the date for Die Kristallnacht, the first official countrywide pogrom against the Jews. November 9th, 1939 was also listed as the selected date for what appears to have been a German intelligence services provocation, an abortive bomb attempt on the life of Adolf Hitler. This meant to spur the enthusiasm on the part of the German populace for war against France, whereas the lightning blitzkrieg of, or the lightning conquest of Poland was well received. A lot of Germans were still relatively hesitant to engage in a long war with a powerful country because they remembered World War I. It is for this reason that November 9th of 1939 was selected as a date for a provocation in order to stimulate enthusiasm for war on the part of the German population. The Berlin Wall came down on November 9th of 1989. So it's a very, very significant date indeed. And I would also notice that, I would note in passing here that Christopher Hitchens dismisses the notion that there was any foul play behind the death of Stieg Larsson. He also notes, though, that the death by heart attack might very well, that it would have required what he called a medical crime, noting the links between not only elements of the Swedish power elite and Nazi elements, but also between the, quote, neo-unquote Nazis and the Swedish intelligence service, which certainly has the capabilities to do things like that, I think raises some very serious questions indeed about the death of Stieg Larsson. However, we're going to be exploring that in side two of the program because we're all out of time here in side one. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 707, Update on Eurofascism. This is being recorded on March 28 of the year 2010. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.